Good morning to all of you. Some things happened this morning. I talked about those at the first hour. If you'd like to listen to the recording, you can find out what was said. I'm not going to try to repeat any of it here. I will tell you that it had to do with how people interact with one another inside the church. When I was finished with the lesson this morning, a person came up to me and said, "You probably ought to know that there were visitors to the church. They came to the 8 o'clock service, and they'll probably never come back because they were sitting someplace in our church, in that sanctuary, and somebody walked up to them and said, 'You're sitting in my pew. You got to move.'" I'm still reeling from that one, which did actually fit pretty well with what I talked about for 5 minutes or so. When another person came up and said, "You need to know what happened in this room this morning." And this room, this morning, I was standing, they said, about there, and they pointed to roughly where Roz is, but out in the aisle. Some people were coming in, and one person looking beyond this person's shoulder at about where you're sitting, Tom, said, "Can you believe those people are sitting in my seat?" And this person, thank God, looked back and said, "I think they haven't been here before. Aren't you happy they're here?" And the response was, "Well, I guess." And they went to their seat. So, I'm suspecting that this is happening in the gathering. And I'm encouraging you to take a little bit of initiative to watch. And if it's happening, gently, kindly, let's not flip this thing 180 degrees where it goes the other way. But just try to think about the impression that we make. We are not necessarily a welcoming church. As I was getting ready to come back in here for your hour, a third person stopped me and said, "The first time I came to this church, 30 years ago, I was renting a house directly across the street. I came into the church building. I came in with my wife and 3 kids, and no one spoke to us. Not a soul. During the service, the pastor said, 'Are there any visitors here?' And me and my family, we all stood up. One person turned around and nodded to us. Nobody else spoke. When the service was over, no one spoke to us. We went and joined another church. We were in that church for about 6 years, and I said, 'This is stupid. I didn't go into that church to be welcomed. I went into that church to worship.' So, still living across the street, he came on in. Now, there's somebody in the room who was there that day, and that person knows what I'm talking about, but I'm not going to tell you who that was. I'll let them tell if they want to. Just be aware. A fourth person said to me, this was a visitor, "I'm so glad you said something. I have a problem, and it's not obvious. I can't walk very far. I have a handicap placard in my car. I can't even carry things in my left arm because if I do, I drop them. But if you don't look closely, you don't realize there's anything wrong with me. I have had people grab me, drag me back to my car in a parking lot, point to my handicap placard, and call me a fraud." I don't think we're necessarily as welcoming here as we think we are. That person said, "I'm glad you said what you did this morning." So, if you want to hear all of what I said, you have to go get the recording for the first hour. That's the website over there. And it'll be posted sometime later today because what happened to me. And I had my reaction this morning. And I vented a little bit. And it turns out that maybe I'm talking about something important. I am so glad that you are here this morning. I welcome you every week. And I think we ought to welcome each other. I try to speak to most of you. I haven't spoken to everybody in the room this morning. But part of that's because I'm still brooding. Genesis 25:19.
Bill, can I say one thing?
You may.
The flip side of that is the reason we came to this church was because they were so welcoming.
We do so good in most ways, but we are not perfect. And I guess the point I was trying to make this morning was we often, with some folks, have one chance. We got one chance. One chance. If it goes wrong on that one chance, it's hard to get that chance back. But I'm glad you're here. Genesis 25, we're starting at verse 19. The first thing I'm going to do is outline for you in rough fashion what is being presented here through the end of chapter 26. So we're starting in the middle of chapter 25, and we're going to look through the end of chapter 26. I have one page of notes on which to do this. When we have finished that, we're going to go back and talk about what some of the things mean in this section. I've got three or four pages of notes for that. So we'll see how far we get. Genesis 25, verse 19. How does it start? Most translations will have this is the story of, or this is the heritage of, or these are the generations of, some phrase like that. 10 or so times in Genesis that phrase is there, and it's really marking out parts of the story that the Bible is trying to tell us. This is the story of Isaac, and it identifies him as son of Abraham. How old was he when he married Rebekah? Please look at verse 20. Your job, by the way, is to skim all the way through to the end of chapter 26 before we get too far along, so that when I start talking about things, you already know what's coming. How old was Isaac when he married Rebekah? Verse 27. How old was he when they had their first children? I'm sorry, that shouldn't have taken that long. 60. Huh. There was a promise to Abraham that you're going to have so many children.
What verse was that you said?
26. 26 or 27? I said 27. Yeah, I'm sorry. 26.
Be more welcoming and don't mess up like that.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Verse 26, he's 60. He's 60. How much time goes on between 40 and 60? 20 years. And during that 20 years, what's happening? Our word for it today would be that old biological clock is going tick-tock, tick-tock. We don't think Rebecca was all that old. We suspect she was quite a bit younger than he is. But 20 years has gone by. The promise to Abraham, you're going to have so many children, so many descendants, not children, so many descendants, that if you could count the grains of sand, you'd still be only part way to counting the descendants you're going to have. And Abraham had one son of promise. He had other children in other ways, but there was one son by Sarah, and God says, this is the son through whom that promise will take place. That son was Isaac. So here's Isaac. He's now 58. He's now 59. No children yet. What's happening? Do you think it might have occurred to Isaac to wonder? Yeah, it did. And what did he do about it? You have to go somewhere in between verse 20 and verse 26. I think it is verse 21. What did Isaac do about it? Prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife, comma, for she was barren. The Lord heard his prayer, and his wife Rebekah conceived. She's now pregnant, and Rebekah's praying to the Lord. What's she praying about? You're still skimming and reading, right? What's she praying about? Quicker, guys. You can do it. Not enough yet. Verse 23. So, the end of verse 22. So she went to consult the Lord. That's my translation. Tail end of verse 22. Does yours have that?
Yes.
What's she consulting? You got to read the whole of verse 22. What's she consulting the Lord about? I thought it was wonderful that she was having a child. Is there any problem here? Yeah, but that's not what she's praying about. Something's going on. There's boxing matches and wrestling matches going on inside of her. It's an awful pregnancy. I do not know what that means. There's no way I could anyway. But whatever was going on, it was unusual enough that she consults the Lord. And the Lord gives her a response honoring her consulting of him. I like the way my translation says. It doesn't say she prayed to him. It says she consulted the Lord. I don't know what verb yours uses.
Inquired.
It's not the word prayer. It's not the word prayed. If you go back to verse 21, Isaac prayed. She consulted. She inquired of the Lord. It's a different verb. Okay? And the Lord gives her a response. And what does he say? There's two nations, two rival people, and you're seeing in your womb a microcosm of the battles that are eventually going to take place. Who are these two nations? Uh-oh. Who are these two nations? Israel through Jacob, Edom through Esau. Edom is Esau's nickname. We'll see in a moment where he gets that nickname from. And Edom is a country. Now, at the end of the lesson last week, I showed you through Lot, there's two countries that come. Through Ishmael, there's a whole bunch of countries that come. And through Esau, there's one. These are the ones that there's just constant enmity between Israel and these various countries. So this is one. And he says to Rebekah, but how does he finish that? How does God finish what he says? He says something very strange. The older will serve the younger. What were the rules in these days? Last week, a nice woman came to me and said, I have a Bible that I'm not sure you've seen. It's called the Archaeological Bible. Some of you last year read through the Bible using the Chronological Bible. Remember that? There's about four or five variations of this. They do not agree on what the right chronology should be. We picked one of them, and that's the one we used for a year last year. Hers is the Archaeological Bible. Nearly every two-page fold-out, you know, you turn the page, here's two more pages before you. Every two pages, there's about a half a page or so of commentary on what archaeology tells about this nature and this time. And this supplements what you read the commentaries. If you read the commentaries, they'll refer to this, but it's all in one place. Very interesting. I checked a copy out of the library to find out whether I want to actually invest in this, so you have to wait for me to turn it in before you can check it out. But probably you could read it for an hour at Barnes & Noble if you wanted to. Anyway, it says that in the nations that we know about that were around this place, there were two different ways of having inheritance. One is sort of like England. The eldest son, girls don't seem to be considered, sorry about that. That's the nature of the world that Isaac was living in. The number one son, the eldest son, would inherit everything. But part of the income that the property would produce would go for a stipend or a payment to each of the other children. And there's another one that talks about the eldest son getting a double portion and the younger children getting a portion. And when I read through that, I'm not quite sure by what I read how to interpret that. If there were, for example, 12 children, what would the eldest son get? It would sound like 2/12 or 2/13. Okay, but I think as I read it more closely, it sounds like what happens is you always have three portions, and the eldest son gets 2/3, and all of the other sons share that one. And if you read the language, I think that's what it means. Okay, so that is what happened with them back there. When you look, there's also provisions that seem to explain something about Ishmael and Isaac, that you could, if your primary wife, I'm quoting now the little article, if the primary wife did not have a child, then a slave could have a child with the master, and that would be adopted by the primary wife as the eldest son. And then if the primary wife later had a child, you'd reverse the order and put things back. That's sort of a parallel to that. What I'm saying is the civilizations, what records we have archaeologically, these aren't things from the Bible, but just from archaeology, seem to support some of this stuff. So, here they are, twins. Which one was born first? That makes him the number one son with all that implies. Who's born second? He's now the afterthought. But what has God said to Rebekah? The elder will serve the younger, implying a reversal of that. So Rebekah has been clued in on that. So as you read what Rebekah did in days to come, we won't get to this point yet, but when you read some of the things Rebekah did, you can almost see Rebekah saying, okay, if that's supposed to happen, I think I was wrong. I don't know that we should be sympathetic to that, but that's something of what happened. So Esau is born. What does he look like when he's born? The Bible says more about the looks of this baby than any baby that's born in the rest of the Bible record. Not just hairy, but hairy with red hair. Looked like he was born in a bear skin, and the bear was red. Okay? And how soon was Jacob born afterwards? Immediately. What's our clue? He was holding on, gripping for dear life to the heel of Esau. So Jacob's name means what? Means grasping. And it's that term that, in the context of the dictionary, has close synonyms of conniving, con artist, trickster. Grasping is sort of the root of that. At least that is one of two that it could be. The other one's a bit more calm and doesn't have that. But most people think that's where it comes. Okay? Now, can you see in the next two verses, verse 27 and 28, how different the children are and the family problems that have emerged? Have you read? Have you skimmed this far that I can go ahead? What's the first thing it says? When Esau grew up, he became a skilled hunter, mine says. Does yours have a modifier there? Expert hunter. And where did he spend his time? Mine says in the open country. Yours may say the open fields, but the open country. So look. And what does he do when he's in the open country? Well, we'll see in just a moment. How about Jacob? What's his life like? Mine says quiet. It doesn't say timid. Does yours say timid? I thought I heard somebody say it.
Tent.
Yeah. He spent his time in the tent. Now, what is the proper description of these two men? Because they're not kids anymore. They're now men. What's the proper description? A man's man. I believe you have a basket that fits with that, right? You put this for the children's auction, right? What did you call it? The
manly man.
Manly man, yeah. Manly man. There's Esau. And Jacob is?
Mama's boy.
Exactly right. You got those are the terms. And what does that do? That once again pushes Esau forward and puts Jacob down. Everybody here? Now, next verse. What does it say about Isaac? Some translations use the word loved. Mine uses the word preferred, and I think that might be closer to the meaning. I doubt he would have rejected Jacob, but he would have preferred Esau. And why did he prefer Esau? He liked venison. Where's Chuck when you need him? He liked wild game, it says. Now, I don't think they had deer there, but they had something else like that. Okay, and he was a hunter. That means he's looking for meat dishes. And, oh, did Isaac like that. How about Rebecca? She preferred Jacob. Well, why wouldn't she?
He's sweet.
He's nice. Okay?
Yeah. Was the Lord telling her, or did that have something to do with her affection for him also?
Maybe. My suspicion is neither one was listening a lot to God. My suspicion is each one had their own opinions for their own reasons, and that God's opinion might line up, might seem on the surface to line up with hers, but the basis for that, I think, was quite different. He spent time with her. One of the things he did, looks like he learned how to cook. Have you had sons? Do they know how to cook?
No.
I know how to cook an egg. Sometimes. Most of the time it works. And I'm pretty good at heating things up. But not in a microwave. I always have to ask, how do I set this? Verse 29 to 34 is awful. And the summary is at the end of verse 34. What's the summary? One translation, I think, said, use the word despised. I don't, again, think that's the best translation. Here's what mine has. I think it's closer. That was all Esau cared about his birthright. He came in hungry could be. He'd been out chasing wild game, and that day they weren't cooperative, or maybe they were cooperative, but he hadn't had time to dress them. He was famished. And Jacob had a meal fixed. I don't know if this was planned or not. The implication is it probably wasn't, except Jacob was ready for the moment. What was he cooking? One version says pottage, and I don't even know what pottage is. One says porridge, and I'm pretty sure it's not porridge.
Mine says stew.
Mine says stew. One says lentils, and I don't know I don't see that in too many of them, but it says stew, but it says something else. It's red. It's red stew. Okay? How many of you know what North Carolina barbecue looks like? As opposed to Texas barbecue. What's the difference? One's got tomato base and one's got a vinegar base. One of them is colorless, or it's the color of the cooked meat. The other one has a red sauce on it. Okay? I think he was fixing Texas barbecue. I think that's what he was fixing. I think it was chili. Something like that. But one translation, I think, it's not mine. One translation gets it right. He was cooking red stuff. That's what it says. Red stuff. And Esau comes in and says, He comes home exhausted, verse 29 says, and he says to Jacob, give me some of that red stuff there. I'm exhausted. And hence the name given to him. What's the name? Edom means red. Have you ever been to Petra? Have you ever seen pictures of Petra? This is not Edom, I think, but it's the kind of look. The thing that strikes you about Petra is the color of the rocks. Red rocks. Red stone. There's places in the United States that would have those colors as well, out in the desert southwest. Red stone, red rock. Okay. Give me some of that red stuff. Jacob said, be happy to. Here's a form. Just sign over your birthright to me. Where did that come from? I don't know. But Jacob seems to have been prepared. There's the trickster. There's the con artist. Here I am at death's door. What use is a birthright to me? And Jacob says, first give me your oath. And Esau gave him his oath and sold his birthright to Jacob. And at that point, Jacob gave him some bread, and that's where it says lentil stew.
What did he say he was about to die?
He's hungry and tired. I don't know why he said he was about to die. Maybe he's using hyperbole, and maybe he was exhausted, and I don't know.
Let's say dinner's ready in 10 minutes.
I don't know. The suggestion is that he wasn't about to die. He was impatient. The implication is that he thought so little of this, he didn't realize what Jacob was doing. And that's the summary in verse 34. That's all Esau cared about his birthright. I don't think the word despise translates that well. I think that's all he cared about it, or that's all that mattered to him. I think that's a closer thing. Yes, ma'am. Indifferent to it. Yeah, I think that's a closer piece. It wasn't something that had any value to him.
That's how Esau shrugged off his rights.
Shrugged off.
Instant gratification.
Mm-hmm. Short term versus long term. No sense of the value that was here. That's all he thought about it. Okay. Pardon?
Sounds like a married couple. Jacob's been slaving over the stew all day.
Interesting that you would think that. I'll have to ponder all that. Yeah. Your neighbor down the street.
I would say Jacob had been watching the soap so he didn't freak an eye.
Jacob's been watching something. There's a suggestion, not just a suggestion, there's a clear statement later that Rebecca is prompting him, and maybe Rebecca was already prompting him, and the Bible hasn't chosen to disclose that yet. But certainly she was prompting him later. Not today, we'll see that later. All right?
In the context, it's really hard to decide, didn't know what he was giving up, right? He's an adult man, he's grown up in this culture. It seems hard to believe that he doesn't realize that he's giving up something significant.
And yet, there it is.
Do you think
he saw any value in it and said, oh, who cares?
Right.
And I think he knew he was signing something away, but he didn't think he was signing away anything of value.
Plus, he was his father's favorite. So
he's his father's favorite. What does a piece of paper mean?
All he cared about was money.
There you go. A little more truth comes out. Chapter 26. What happens in chapter 26? What happens in chapter 26 is fascinating. And in order to understand what's happening here, you have to back up. There was a point where there was a famine. And when that famine came, Abraham took his family and he went to Egypt. And when he got to Egypt, he started to worry. Now, God had told him, I'm going to bless you, I'm going to watch over you, and all this kind of, but he got worried, they could kill me down here. And so he said, she's my sister, pointing to his wife. And Pharaoh took Sarah into his harem. And all kinds of terrible things began to happen. The duplicity and the deception all came out. He was kicked out of Egypt by Pharaoh with some indignity. And not only that, he'd done it again. When he did it the second time, it was with a king named Abimelech in a place called Philistine, for which one of the major cities was a place called Gehar. Very interesting. And then once again, this is my sister. And Abimelech takes her into the harem. And the picture we have probably is that the trading of women in your retinue would make for a peace treaty of some kind. This happened for centuries, for thousands of years after this. Okay. But in any event, it was found out, and Abimelech got real upset with Abraham and then finally ended up settling with him. Almost everything that happened with Abraham gets repeated. The famine comes, and what's the first thing he does? Heads off to Egypt. And God comes to Isaac, and says to him, stop, don't go to Egypt. And where does he stop him? In Gerar, that same place that his father had this interaction with Abimelech a long time before. Who's the king of this area at this time? Still Abimelech. Is it the same Abimelech? We don't know. Talked to somebody on Wednesday night of this week. He was all upset. There had been some genealogy work that had come to his attention within the last few months. And he was still mad about it because he discovered that all this time he had thought he was a junior, and he found out that his granddaddy had the same name. He was really a third. And I suggested he might be a fourth, and he had to wait and find out. But he was all upset. This could have been Abimelech Jr., Abimelech the third. We just don't know. But it's the same name, king, in the same place. And all of a sudden he's acting the same way because Isaac points to Rebekah and says, this is my sister. The way they found out that this was duplicitous and deceptive is interesting. Your Bible probably uses the word caress for what Isaac was doing to her in a garden where he thought no one could see. Mine is a bit more blunt. It says fondled. And so it all comes out. It's as if he's reliving his father's mistakes, and he doesn't seem to know any better. Now, what's God's reaction? God stops him on the way to Egypt from keeping him to make it worse. And even after, what has he done? First of all, he's been deceptive to Abimelech. Second, he's been disrespectful to God. He knew that going to Egypt for his daddy was the wrong thing. He should have figured out it was wrong for him. Secondly, he knew that the telling somebody the lie that this is my sister wasn't a good thing. But why would he have told that lie? It would have been he was afraid Abimelech might kill him in order to take his possessions. That means he's distrusting God. He doesn't trust God for his protection. So all these things are swirling around, most of which are sins against God. And what does God do? Verse 12, verse 13, verse 14 of chapter 26. God blesses him like crazy. At which point Abimelech begins to move him out. He's already put him under his protection. He says, anybody who touches this man or his wife is going to be put to death. But at this point, and you sort of see it because Abimelech's servants are closing up the wells. Isaac has herds, the herds need water, and Abimelech's servants are closing up the wells. So Isaac begins to move until he gets far enough away that nobody's closing up the wells anymore. And then even after that, this is verse 22, he finally found a place. No dispute over this one. Named the place Rehoboth and said, the Lord has made room for us to thrive in this country. And that's what that word means, is space. Okay. So, he doesn't stay there though. Verse 23, he goes up to Beersheba. Now it's interesting. I don't think the name Beersheba had been given to this place yet. This is being written looking back. And so it was written so the people who read this would have understood the place he means. But the name Beersheba hadn't quite been given to this place yet. And the Lord appears to him a second time. And what is the Lord doing this time? What does he do? Reaffirms all of the covenant in spite of all this that he's done. And Isaac worships him. There's a little bit more to this. Down through verse 33, Abimelech comes in and he says, you're powerful, I'm powerful, we need to have a peace treaty between us. Abimelech does bring along the commander of his army, and it's unlikely the commander of his army would go anywhere without a contingent of the army with him. So I think there is a show of force behind this. They sign a peace treaty. Verse 31, early the next morning, they exchanged oaths. And Isaac bade them farewell, and they left him as friends. Next verse, it happened that same day that Isaac's servants brought him news. Now, I want you to pause for just a minute. If you go back a little bit, let me see if I can find the place. Verse 25. He's at Beersheba. God has appeared to him. He has built an altar and invoked the name of the Lord. What's the rest of verse 25 say? Pitched his tent. That means he's setting up a place. He's going to stay there a while. And what else does it say? They dug a well. Mine says they sank a well. Let me ask you a question. When you start digging a well, when do you stop? Good. Then the translation is not correct. He didn't dig a well. They started to dig a well. Because take a look where we were just now. This is in verse 31. Isaac bade them farewell and they left his friends. Verse 32, it happened that on that very day, Isaac's servants brought him news. What was the news? We hit water. So I think they were digging the well. And I suspect the translators somehow have I suspect there's something there that would have allowed them if they felt like to say they started digging a well but chose to say it differently. But or maybe they dug a well and got a little bit of water and now they've dug more and are hitting more. I don't know.
The message says started digging.
Yeah. We found water, they said, and he called the well Sheba, and the town is named Beersheba, and I'm told that that is a combination of peace. That's the peace treaty that was signed that day and was finalized that day, and water or provision or something like that, because now the animals have something to drink. They have something. You can live if you've got water. All right? Now, that's the story. Okay? We have approximately 6 minutes to go back and begin the process of looking at this next three pages of notes and what we've learned so far. So let me begin here. God chose Abraham. Abraham has at least two sons, Ishmael and Isaac. God chooses Isaac. Isaac has two sons, Esau and Jacob. God chooses Jacob. When did God choose Jacob over Esau? Before they were born. Why did God do that? We're going to have to deal with that. Why did he choose Isaac over Ishmael? It's a little cleaner there because one is the child of the primary wife. It's almost like God is saying to you, now wait a minute, if you thought Isaac and Ishmael was done on the basis that one was the child of the primary wife and one wasn't, try this on for size. Here's Esau and Jacob. If you go to the New Testament, there's a long section that comments on this. And one of the things it says is God accepted or loved Isaac and he rejected Esau. Why would God do that? We have to deal with that, guys. We have to deal with that. The answer starts with I. And if you've been here a while, you know how to finish that. I don't know. And you don't either. God says in several places through his prophets, I choose whom I choose and I reject who I reject. And it's as if to say, you are not given the whys. There is, in the New Testament, a section that talks about God's elect, chosen from the foundation of the world. God has accepted some, called some, rejected others. We have to deal with this. Let me tell you how one person dealt with this, and this is still alive. It's called Calvinism. Calvin deals with this with 5 points, which sum up to God is going to save the ones he intended to save at the foundation of the world, and he is going to reject the ones that he intended at the foundation of the world to reject. And there's nothing you or I can do about that. If God plans to save you, you're going to be saved. If God doesn't, there's not a thing you can do to change God's mind.
Well, we know why he chose him, because he knew him would be godless and his covenant would be broken.
See, that's tempting. To think God looks forward, because God is not trapped by time, to think he looks forward and says, okay, here's how it came out, so I'm going to go back here and reject it. And that's tempting. And it's so tempting that I think there's probably truth there. Don't hear me rejecting that. I think there's truth there. But we still got to grapple with this, because let me take you to the question. We're low on time. Let me take you to the question. The question you got to deal with is this. Let me try to read it, because I've written it down. If God has determined to save certain people and exclude others, what role is left for my or our witness, testimony, or evangelism? We have to deal with this. Calvinism is loose and strong in Baptist circles, in some Baptist circles today. leader of one of the Central Baptist seminaries, is a very, very strong 5-point Calvinist, as they say. Some are 4-point. They sort of back off on 1 point.
Well, I'm not an expert in Calvinism theology, but my question would be, does it mean that if Calvinism states is exactly correct, does that mean that I'm saved by the blood and grace of Jesus Christ, because at the beginnings of the earth, Christ knew that I would be born and I'd be heathen, but I would be saved because of Christ?
I believe that a Calvinist would say yes to that question. But I want to take you to a slightly different place, because I think there are some problems with that question. Because what does that invite you to do? That invites you just nothing for me to do.
Can't wait to tell Dave.
Yeah. Okay. Now, let me give you what I think are three things to think about. Number one, we do not know who God's elect are. We do not know who God's elect are. You and I don't know. There's a place in the Gospels where Jesus says to his followers, do not judge. What's the rest of it? So that you won't be judged. Does that mean we should not have judges? Of course not. It can't mean that. So what does it mean? What it means is, don't you look at somebody and say, God can't use that person. That person is going to hell.
That's God's job.
That's God's job.
That's no different than walking to church saying you took my seat. I'm more worthy of that
seat. Let me say, I think they are closer than I like. And maybe that's why it's bothering me so much this morning. Yeah. There's a place in James that says, watch what you do in your churches. You see some guy come in, rich clothes and a gold ring, and a poor guy, shabbily dressed, and you say to the one that's got the ring, this is James 2, come sit here in the best seats. And you say, go sit over there. Get out of the way. He says, that's not the way it works. God's not looking at those externals, and you better not either. But there's a role in this, and I don't know if it's easy to tease out, but let me just say again, we do not know who God's elect are. Number two, we do not know the process God has chosen whereby those people will be called. Because calling is clearly part of the election. He calls out his elect. Maybe part of that process is a piece that we have. Mm-hmm. Most important, we do not know the role we are to play in that process. Given those three facts, we choose or ought to choose to act as if salvation for any individual hangs in the balance. Because we do not know what God knows. We are not where he sits. Let me summarize it this way, and then I'll take your question. David Jeremiah is a person that I think every once in a while has some really thoughtful things to say. And one of the things I remember him saying one time is, when we get to heaven and we walk in the door, there's going to be a big banner over the door that we walk in that says, whosoever will may enter. And when we walk through and look back, it's going to say, here comes God's elect. Because the same Bible that says God's elect also says whosoever will. There is a mystery here that is deeper than we know. But hiding in God's choice is a process of calling out God's chosen people. And if God calls you, you want to be part of the elect? Respond to his call. And son of a gun, from the foundation of the earth, you will have been. And I don't know how to say it any better than that.
That's good. I'm just drawn to this verse that says in 2 Corinthians, where it says, for Christ's love compels us because we are convinced that one died for all. And then in verse 15, and he died for all.
And so, this is, by the way, the reaction that's starting to come of universalism. That everybody's going to be saved.
Well,
and they point to verses like that. And there's a tightrope in between those two extremes.
But the verse finishes, it says, and he died for all, that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for him who died for them and was raised again. So he died for everybody, but it's the only people that really live are the ones that are saved.
I've run out of time, so I'm going to have to trust you to do a little bit of homework. get a piece of paper if you want to do this. Get a pen.
Blaine, what's that scripture?
2 Corinthians 5:15.
Okay. I would have taken you, if I had had time, to 1 Corinthians 1:21 and the verses around it. I would have taken you to Romans 1, verses 16 and 17. And I would have taken you to Ephesians 2, and we would have looked at verses 1 through about 22, and then we would have gone into chapter 3 and looked at verses 14 through 21. Let me tell you the heart.
What was the Romans 1 again?
Romans 1, 16 and 17. Ephesians 2 starts out this way. Paul, when he says you, is speaking to Gentiles. When he says we, he is speaking to himself and other Jewish people. He says, you were dead. All the things you were doing, you were dead. We were too. All of us were following the ruler of this world. But God, in Christ, made us alive. And it was all His grace. There's nothing there that we can boast about. There's nothing we did that merited that. And somehow we have this walk to make that allows God to do what He has said He has done, is to call out those who are His own. And yet at the same time, realize that in the things we do, eternity is hanging in the balance for the people around us. There's a good chance that some people will come to salvation because of your witness, and you'll never know it happened. And there is a frightening chance that somebody will not, because of a moment of saying, you're sitting in my pew, and they never come back. And that's why I said what I did at the first of the hour. Yes, ma'am, and we're done. You get the last word.
The Bible was talking about God's patience so that none can be lost.
He wants none to be lost. Universalism says He gets what He wants. Calvinism says, no, He's decided there's some that just aren't going to make it, and there's some that are. Somewhere where I live, where you live, I think we're walking down the middle. Okay. God is not trapped in time, and I think that's the piece that's so attractive about that part. There's a lot here to ponder. Let's have a word of prayer so we can go. Our Father, we thank You for this day. We thank You for the word that comes to parents to help us know what we can do and what we can't do, and to tell the difference. But I still pray for parents, and I still pray for children. And I pray that You would call the children to You, to have them see the future You want for them, the future that does not have them in misery, in isolation. But also I pray for the parents, that You would give them peace within the storms that they deal with. And I thank You for this church in which we can confront these hard things. I thank You for these good people who meet in this place. And I pray that You would guide them to be hospitable and welcoming, to ponder the things they do, not to be so concerned with appearances of how I look to somebody else, but just to naturally be welcoming and be open to the person who is new and the person who is seeking. Lord, our thoughts are complicated today, but You have a simple message of love that You want to give us, and through us You want to give to others. Help that message be heard clearly in our hearts and passed on clearly to the hearts of those You're calling. For we ask all this in Your Son's name.